Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Primary Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. I want to start off by saying Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year's. I'm not sure if I'm going to get another one of these out before the beginning of the year. Already I hear that everybody's telling me that they're sick of the holiday. They're ready for it to be over. I can understand that. As you get older, things aren't as fun as they used to be because whereas when you were a child, you and I both know it was mostly, for those of us who had the privilege of having this life, it was a time of immense pleasure, of waiting for pleasure, of getting pleasure, of, basking in pleasure. Of course, you get a little bit older than that, pleasure means a whole different thing. But, when you're pre-pubescent, there's an innocence still to Christmas. And when you get older, it's the madness that kind of gets you. The madness of getting gifts for everybody, for your children. There's still pleasure in it, but it's a different type, and I can understand why people are ready for it to be over. In its vein, I guess, V-I-N. Wanted to take this moment out for the Class War Battlefield Podcast to say thank you all. I released 2 episodes at the beginning of this year, 3 episodes at the end of last year, and if you go into the archives, if you just go to the top of the page here and click on Class War Battlefield Podcast on radioforall.net, you won't see any of those listed, actually. And the reason for that is I put them under a different account. I couldn't access this one, ironically, but boom, I'm back. But when I published those, I was not certain if I was going to keep publishing the Class War Battlefield Podcast. In fact, I was almost ready, and I had actually produced a series finale podcast. I was ready to do it. I was ready to let this go. And I was ready to let it go to concentrate on my new podcast, which will be coming out. Well, it's kind of already been out, but it's will definitely be publishing on a more regular schedule coming up in the next few months. But I was ready to let this go. And those other 5 were they were not very, but they were definitely different than the ones that you're listening to now. They included all of these clips beforehand, and a very fanciful, though albeit long, title. Whereas I don't necessarily miss the title format, I do miss the clips. I used to put about an hour to an hour and 15, an hour and 20 minutes worth of news clips that most of us don't know exist on before I actually started talking. And there was a lot of information in there that most of us don't know about. But as I am a worksman at the time, I'm at the bottom rung of society, like you, or some of you anyway. The time that it took to amass the clips, to edit the clips, to put them together, was unsustainable. I was working a full week, then I was working almost 2 days in addition to prepare the podcast, so I had no time for anything else, and even though I found it somewhat enjoyable, other work that I needed to get done began to slip and fall, and so I had to make a judgment call. But as things progressed in the year, I wanted to produce more of these podcasts, even as I was working on my other one. And late in this past summer, particularly after the conventions, I kind of started knowing that this podcast was going to be necessary again. I recorded a pre-Donald Trump election show, and I never, of course, released it. And I almost feared releasing it. I almost feared releasing it because I used to joke about Donald Trump being elected, and I would say, oh, I want Donald Trump to win because this country deserves Donald Trump as a president, and I actually still stand by that. The country does deserve Donald Trump as a president. But deep down inside, I knew, excuse me, if he became president, what that would mean. That would mean fascism, but it would, people use that word way too much. And when they use it, they think about Nazi Germany, and they think about Italy. Fascism existed before Nazi Germany, and it existed before Italy. And it existed in this country for a long time. The primal concept, or the primal characteristic of fascism, is not, as most people think, socialistic. And actually, let me back up on that, because it is actually somewhat socialistic, but you have two ends of socialism. You have socialism, which is deeply rooted in the public and in the social structure, which we often just call socialism. And then you have socialization, which is deeply rooted in corporations and power, and actually usurps the energy of the public. What makes it socialized? What makes it socialized is that it is widespreading and it impacts every person. And every person is forced to participate in it, whether or not they want to. Now, with socialization, you may have to participate in it, but you still have a majority say in it, and what the decisions that impact the execution is still on you. So it's kind of ironic. We don't often think about it, but government as a concept has to be socialistic. It has to be. If it is not, then government then turns into monarchy or some form of that, where a group of people just tell you what to do. It's kind of, you know, you can't have democracy without socialization for the general public and for the people. You can't do it. Just like you cannot have totalitarianism without an empowerment of a few people over the masses. So I knew that this was going to be what was happening. Now, when I talk about fascism from Donald Trump, I'm not talking about czars, which is what Fox News had determined Barack Obama was. He was a czar. He had, you know, unchallenged power. He could do whatever he wanted to. That was a trip and a half. The predominant characteristic of American fascism, and this goes back to the late 1800s during the Industrial Revolution, the predominant characteristic is corporate and state merged together. And they merge together against the welfare, which is not a bad word. You actually have to go and look it up. Welfare. Against the social welfare, the social betterment, the social commonwealth of the people. That has been the predominant characteristic of American fascism. And indeed, historian Gerald Horn made me really think about an idea and a concept that I've had for quite some time, where I looked at the Ku Klux Klan as a fascistic organization. The Ku Klux Klan, which did not only exist in great numbers in the South, but existed in even greater numbers in some aspects in the North. A book that I read some years back pointed out that one of the largest Klan rallies ever in this country took place in New Jersey. New Jersey, and this was in the 1900s. But the Ku Klux Klan, and this is not controversial, this is actually well known, you know, we all know about Bull Connor. Do not forget, their membership, outside of just just including your basic, what people often say, redneck, you know, the poor man on the bottom of the totem pole, the administrators and the heads of each Ku Klux Klan sect, and indeed the regional and the statewide and the national sects, were rich, were people of great respect and repute in the community. They were businessmen and women, mostly men back in those days, but they were businessmen. They were men with great power, with great resources, with great money, with great influence, not only in their state, but in other states. And sometimes in other countries. This was who the Ku Klux Klan was. And by that definition, They were a social organization and a secret society. We never can forget that part. They were a secret society. But by definition, they were fascistic. In many towns and communities, Klan rule was the law. And in many states, Klan desires ruled legislation. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. You don't, as an organization, get to initiate a president, which I never can remember what president it was who was initiated. Maybe it wasn't Wilson. Almost said it was Wilson. But you don't get to initiate a president into your organization unless you have business backing. You don't. And that's the type of fascism that this country has built itself on. Gerald Horn, how he made me think about this, was he took what I had conceived of, and he pulled it back through history and said, look at slavery. Slavery was a fascistic organization. You had, in many parts of the South, and actually, by its end, most parts of the South, a population which was on par or larger than the white population, being controlled by terror. And they were being controlled by terror by a business organization which doubled as a social organization. This is a textbook definition of terrorism. Fascism. Of course it was terrorism, but not only was were these people being terrorized by this organization, this predominant organization, but these celled organizations were built steeped in patriotism and nationalism and the fervor of the good white destiny against the dark black destiny. This is fascism. And the fact that the first 150 years existed in this state for this country, and that if you count it colonialism, you have 250 years almost of that type of a reality existing in this country. Because it didn't stop when slavery ended. There was a brief reconstruction, then there was 90 plus years of segregation and violence. But this is what you had. This is what you had. And he made me realize that when Americans talk about fascism, they point to Italy, they point to Germany. When they talk about dictators, they point to anybody else, and you name it, they point to it. But this country has had a very long history, a flirtation with fascism. Moreover, Gerald Horn suggested that each year when there's elections, the so-called left runs back and forth like chickens with their heads cut off, saying that we all need to vote because the country is in terrible condition and that it is almost teetering towards fascism. Well, why is that? If this country had such strong democratic roots, then that teetering would not be taking place. Well, the reason it is teetering, particularly lately, is because of the history and the long history of not only the United States, but the colonies. And when I look at someone like Donald Trump, and I look at who he's putting on his staff, some of which, by the way, has not been highly publicized, may I say. The people who's on his economic council, not highly publicized. That's a big one, by the way. But he reminds me of that late 1800 type of industrialist financial baron. Now, mind you, I don't believe Donald Trump is as smart as a lot of other people think he is. I don't. In fact, I believe Donald Trump is mostly there as a tool and as a puppet. And if he was to really get out of hand, you know, he'd be done. And they wouldn't shed a tear. They got the guy who they really want there, which is why Bush never stepped out of line. It's because Bush understood it was going to be Cheney. That's who the power brokers wanted in power, and Bush was just the head. Donald Trump is the same thing. If Donald Trump doesn't go along with the script, he'll die of a heart attack. He's 70 years old. I said it in one of my earlier episodes. So, I don't believe, you know, he is who people think he is. And I do believe that Hillary Clinton was not allowed to take the position, to take the White House, because essentially she was going to be running a third Clinton term. And I don't know if people understood the snow job that was actually going on. It took me a while to see it. It took me a long while to see it, but ladies and gentlemen, I will say it again, and I know people don't like it, but the wealthy did not want her as president. And the only reason why, you know, after really looking at all of this, the only reason why I can think of is because they were afraid of her. They were afraid of her. Now, I'm not a Clinton apologist. I'm not saying the Clintons haven't done stupid things. I'm not saying they haven't done wrong things. But I want you to point to me a politician who have made it to that top of the level who has, who hasn't. All right, maybe Barack Obama might have his hands really clean. But there's something fishy about that. Every single outlet was against Hillary and Bill Clinton. And yet, nobody, the same people who were yelling about Hillary Clinton, said a mumbling word about Donald Trump. It was so bad that the people who were beating up on Hillary Clinton during the campaign could not get themselves over the first 2 weeks after Donald Trump was elected. They couldn't get over her. They couldn't. And even to this late date right now, many of them are still refusing to actually admit the type of danger that they had allowed to ascend to the White House. Like I said, not a Clinton apologist. But I find it odd and frightening that the people who wanted to do an incredible amount of sleuthing against Bill and Hillary Clinton to take them down, to make sure they didn't get into office, did not do the same type of work for Donald Trump. They would do things like, oh, well, look at him and he's racist and blah, blah, blah. That ain't nothing. These people pulled out all the stops. They went after the Clinton Foundation. They went, you know, a lot of these people were talking about murder and what have you. It was a full-fledged assault to make sure that she didn't get to power. But they forgot about him. And I worry about that. I worry about it. Now, at the same time, I got to say, the Green Party, who have proven themselves and may have just really cost themselves any kind of credibility with Jill Stein heading up the efforts of the recount. But the Green Party, who should have seen this coming from freaking 5 years ago when Occupy Wall Street started, the Green Party has done nothing to situate themselves to be the party of the grassroots. They have had no organizational structure. They have had no organizational drive and determination to build their ranks or to build a national structure so that they can proceed, like the Tea Party, to influence the policies of the people who they say that they represent. This is something that has been troubling to me for quite some time. And it remains troubling, especially now that Stein is being seen as little more than a extension of the Democratic Party, leading many people to start to question if there was a reason why the Green Party hadn't actually initiated a full-fledged drive to organize in many states. Was there some kind of backroom deal between the Green Party and the Democratic Party to make it look like the Green Party was the true left party and the Democrats were the reasonable centrists? Was there that type of a deal? There might have been. Maybe that's why Cynthia McKinney was really blacked out from most of the people who wanted to cover the Green Party candidate in 2008. You know? She would have been a really... Cynthia McKinney would have been an incredible catch or a presidential candidate in 2012 when Barack Obama's star had begun to fade. And I think she would have been a dynamic, a real strong dynamic presidential candidate this year. I think she would have garnered way more support than Jill Stein. So that's me. But people are asking these questions, and they are important questions. And if they're not asking these questions... I heard one person ask the question. But if they're not asking these questions, these things need to be planted in your head right now, because if you were mounting a true grassroots campaign for the people, and you had a party which you said, this is for the people, so we're going to build this organization, and you knew, or you watched the upswelling of dissatisfaction in the autumn of 2011. I mean, a dissatisfaction. People can say what they want to always about the Occupy Wall Street movement, as it was called. And people do. They say, oh, well, it was just George Soros. George Soros did. Yeah, George Soros. Okay, let's... I'm going to give you a handout here. Let's say George Soros funded Zuccotti Park. Zuccotti Park was getting no coverage, no news coverage. Nobody cared. It was just dead airspace. For 3 weeks, they got nothing. And then it blew up. And all because the New York City Police Department acted stupidly. And whereas they couldn't get coverage on most podcasts, most news organizations, nothing. Suddenly, Occupy was all over the place. So you're there. You're the Green Party. You're watching this. You are about to enter the 2012 election. You are saying now on the ground, we're doing the work for the 99%. We're doing the work for the 99%. Now, mind you, in a month's time, you had
2,000 of these encampments across the country in a month's time. George Soros did not plan that. You had camps ranging from several hundred people, a couple of them had a couple of thousand people, to a few dozen people. George Soros didn't plan that. And that's the scary part for these people who actually do plan these type of things. Is they are lucky if they can plan a dozen or two dozen of these things and get a decent 100 or 200 people after 2 or 3 years worth of work. In 1 month's span, from the end of September to the end of October, you had 2,000 sites checking in across this country. And even if you say, well, some of them weren't really active, cut it in half. 1,000 of them were active. Cut that in half. 500 of them were active. Let's say a fourth of what I said was active. They had multiple, they had dozens of people at least. So they were actually organizing. In a month, you had 500 of these things. You had multiple organizations coming together in inner cities, in communities, rural and suburban alike. Dozens, hundreds, couple of them, thousands of people. That's power. And that happened in a month. A month. A month. That means you had, if we even take just the 500, you had 15 to 20 of these things popping up every day. That's organic. That's organic. And that's huge. But so you're the Green Party. How do you not take advantage of this? Now, of course, people were running around, oh, well, we're the Green Party. We're doing the work for the 99%. Where's the organization? Where was the mobilization? You had a month to get it right. Really, you only had a week and a half to get it right. Now, this is something that they should be embarrassed about. You're going to call yourself a grassroots organization and you can't mobilize yourself. You should, they are the best well-known grassroots political party in the country. And they couldn't organize themselves in a couple of weeks. But then we go back to the question. Is it deliberate? Have they not been willing or able to organize themselves because, da-da-da, they are arms of the Democratic Party? Jill Stein put them in a really, really bad spot by spearheading this this recount. She put them in a really bad spot. And it's a shame because we're going to need true people's parties like the Green Parties. Because the Democratic Party ain't changing. They're part of the problem. You don't put a man like Chuck Schumer, who is in no way demonstrated that he is progressive, that he's going to do the right thing, in charge of your party for the future and say, look, we're doing something better. Hell, they don't even have any black people on this new board of, you know, what's going to be the new Democratic Party. So give me a break. Give me a break. But as we're looking at Donald Trump being sworn in as the 45th president, as we're looking at this, we're all worried about fascism. I'm worried about austerity too. I'm also worried about the people who don't understand what they really truthfully voted for. Everybody is, they're making up excuses. Okay, the economy's bad. They didn't like the whole NAFTA thing from the Clintons. A lot of people fail to realize that NAFTA was shoved down the, well, it wasn't necessarily shoved down the Clintons' gullet. But if memory serves me correctly, NAFTA was the product of not only right-wing Democrats, but a very hostile congressional session, which saw the GOP at the same time that Clinton rose to prominence also come to prominence. And they sought open border deals for their business contacts. And people, again, forget the first 2 years of the Clinton administration were still fraught with hardships. And when the GOP came to power in 94, if memory serves me correctly, that those hardships didn't go away. Don't forget, Clinton, both of them, spent a lot of capital trying to pass a universal health care bill in the first 2 years of the presidency. By the time the GOP came through, which the GOP really ran against that and said, well, this is going to be a step towards socialized medicine, and this is going to be negative and bad for all of you, yada, 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 yada. This has been the GOP's argument forever. You know, socialize corporate America, do not socialize anything for the people. They're fascist, true and true. But. NAFTA was part of that concession. And the GOP, Donald Trump, can try to act like they didn't run for it, but they did. And they have held firm to it. And most of the tax breaks, which wealthy people have gotten, have come from GOP administrations. People do not like to, everybody likes to try to make up statistics that help them out a lot. But since this country took a severe right-wing turn, which included deregulation, you go back to Ronald Reagan when that turn happened. And the predominant party that has been in the White House has been GOP. Don't believe me? Do the math. You got Ronald Reagan for 2 years, Bush, Clinton, Bush, so you got 3-1 already, Obama, 3-2, Trump, 4-2. You stay with that two-gap ratio. You go back to Carter, that it shrinks to 1. Then you go back to Ford, expands to 2. Nixon, 3. LBJ, 2. JFK, 1. Eisenhower, 2. Seeing a pattern here? Truman, 1. FDR, 0. So it takes all the way back to FDR to get it equal. All the way back to FDR to get it equal. And by the way, I'm just counting presidents. I'm not counting years. I'm not counting years. Or elections won. But simple math will tell you. Simple math will tell you. And by the way, I'm telling you, the same thing holds true for control of the legislature. Now, it took them a while to capture that, but it still holds true. I'm pretty confident. I haven't done the math yet, but I know at least in my lifetime, the 90s, the first and the second decades of the 2000s, and even I think the second half of the 80s, I think the Republicans were the dominant party in the House, in the Senate. Maybe the House, the Senate might have been more Democrats, but either way. For the White House, this is the person who is supposedly setting the agenda has predominantly been Republican. And you can't run from that, because since the early 80s, the Republicans have been, actually, since the mid-60s, the Republicans have been the dogmatically conservative party. They've been the party for big business. Not to say that Democrats hadn't, you know, tried to get themselves onto that corporate teat either, but this is why I have made statement after statement saying that I don't believe that the people who they're saying, oh, well, this is just economic. No, I don't believe that crap. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I'm not going to believe it. Now, because if it was economic, then they would have sent a major message to both parties. And they didn't. They ran to the same party that they keep running to, that keeps screwing them time and time and time again. All of these people in the Midwest, all of these people who are now in their early 30s and late 20s, particularly early 30s, because if you're in your early 30s, that meant that you got to vote, most likely, in the 2000 or the 2004 election. Sometimes and, so. But many of those people who had voted for George W. Bush, and many of them did, must accept responsibility, because many of those people have college bills, which they can now not bankruptcy out of, because George W. Bush in 2005, I believe, passed a law saying that you can't do that anymore. The housing bubble and crises which took place, George W. Bush. And this is, you can't keep saying that it's economic if you're not going to make a fundamental and radical change towards economics. If you think that the Republicans are going to be your savior, you need to show me proof that they have done anything but be stooges of the corporations. Which brings me back to Donald J. Trump. Ladies and gentlemen, before I leave you for this beautiful Christmas, he's already telling us what he's going to do. He's already telling us that that fascism is back in style, and that no matter what we think, we're going to have to deal with it. He's also telling us that austerity is back in style. If you don't know what austerity is, because most of us really don't know, and you know how I know most of us don't know? Because I looked up the word. I heard people talking about austerity, and the only thing that they'd say about it is that it was about shrinking the amount of money that was available for public services. But when you look it up, that is not particularly what austerity is about. It's far more violent. And it actually goes along with something that the GOP has said that it wanted to do for a long time. Namely, shrink government down to a small enough size where it could drown it in a bathtub. Think about that. They want to shrink government down to the size enough where they can drown it in a bathtub. What would this mean for every woman, man, and child in this country? That would mean that you would have to go to a business constantly to get whatever you need. Not only to get whatever you need, but to get whatever you don't need. Meaning, some of us have quirks, you know, we like certain things, certain ways. If you were to remove, let's just say you're a fan of oils, you know, great smelling oils for your home. So you have regulations regulating what could be in there, and sometimes you even have regulations for how much those things can cost, taxes that are on it, what have you. Historically, especially if we look at the Industrial Revolution, without such limits, without such borders, greed is going to take over because the people at the top of the society, particularly a capitalist society, have to be greedy. And so, if you take away those rules mandating that their greed is placed in check, you're going to go from paying $4.50 for your good oils to paying $40.20 because they can charge that. Austerity aids in this. And you're starting to see this. The privatization of public education is a austerity move. It is something that racists, yes, racists, I'm not being hyperbolic here, racists said that they wanted to do back in the 60s. They wanted to privatize schools to stop segregation. They wanted to privatize schools to prevent black people from going to, or too many black people from going to white schools. They wanted to use vouchers for that same reason. This was back in the 60s, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, it was back in the late 50s when this began. This isn't hyperbolic. You can go and look it up. This is true. This is true. Now, that's kind of shifted. I mean, actually, it hasn't really shifted. I believe it's still part of the agenda. They just don't say it. They talk about failing schools. But that's austerity. It's about ripping government programs in out of the government and placing it in private hands for profit. That's what it's about. That is what it's about. And that's where we're headed. The fascism only enables austerity to ratchet up. It does. It does. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Merry Christmas. It's been a rough couple of months, but you know, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful because I think people are going to start waking up. I'm hopeful because I can feel people wanting to do better. I feel a lot more animosity, which I hate, but it's what it is. I can feel the tension in the air. And I can feel there's people who want to do something about that. Alright. I've been waiting for something to happen. Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Hanukkah. And if I don't see you before the beginning of the year, I love you all. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. Have a blessed, blessed New Year. Don't forget to set those resolutions. Reinforce them in the spring, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time to do it. This is the time to do it. This is Vimer Dees. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And there are lights in the balance.